Olá, bom dia a todos. Gostaria de agradecer a presença de vocês e avisar que essa apresentação vai ter a maior parte dela em inglês. Então, inclusive, se vocês quiserem fazer perguntas pelo sistema de Q&A da ferramenta e preferirem mandar em português, pode mandar que eu vou estar aqui para poder traduzir. So now I'll change to English so everyone can understand me. Good morning, everyone. My name is Tatiana Sali. I am the consultant for the Green Bonds Working Group of the Lab, the Laboratory for Financial Innovation, which is a partnership of the IDB, CVM, and ABDE. And this webinar is in partnership with GIZ, from where we are going to talk about the behind the scenes, the Ambitious Sustainable Policy Framework of the European Union, and how it will become the benchmark for policymakers and what can be applied to Brazil. So first of all, I would like to thank everyone for their attendance and in the name of the lab and in the name of all the speakers here. And just to make sure you know what the lab is a forum where we have discussions and we talk to public and private sectors on how to be able to attend and to deliver the SDGs and the Paris Agreement. And today we are very happy to have the presence Ms. Elida from the Minister of Economy. She is the coordinator of financial systems at the Secretaria de Política Econômica, or the Economic Policy Secretariat. We also have Mr. Carson Loeffler. He's co-head of the Frankfurt School and UNEP Collaborating Center for Climate and Sustainable Energy Finance. And the webinar is going to be moderated by Mr. Sebastian Sommer. He's the director of GIZ for the Green Finance Project. So I wish everyone a great webinar, and I hope it is something that we can use in the lab and in future conversations. And now I can give the floor to Mr. Sebastian Sommer, who will take care of us today. Thank you, everyone.
Estás a ouvir-me bem?
Perfeito.
Ok. Bem-vindo e bom dia para todos e todas. Obrigado ao LABI para hospedar este webinar. Meu nome é Sebastian Sommer e sou o diretor de projeto que trata da promoção das finanças verdes. O projeto ocorre no âmbito da cooperação técnica entre a Alemanha e o Brasil, o Ministério da Economia Brasileiro, o Banco Central do Brasil e o Ministério Federal da Cooperação, Economia e do Desenvolvimento Alemão, BMZ, estão colaborando pela primeira vez num projeto de cooperação técnica. A execução da contribuição alemã será assegurada pela GIZ, a instituição que eu represento. Como já foi referido, a contribuição técnica hoje será em inglês, e por isso que eu também vou mudar o idioma agora, também para poupar vocês de meu português. Por favor, desculpe-me por isto. So once again, welcome to the webinar. Behind the scenes, the EU's ambitious green finance policy framework. Will it become the next benchmark for policymakers and what can be applied in Brazil? We have a tight agenda today, so I will not stand between you and an interesting input and discussion for too long. Just some housekeeping issues. The agenda looks as follows. It was already presented. We have about 90 minutes. So after a short introduction from myself, we will have some welcoming words by Elida Francioni, Coordinador Geral de Sistemas Financeiros, Secretaria de Política Econômica del Ministerio da Economía. And thereafter, Carsten Loeffler, co-head of the Frankfurt School UNEP Collaborating Center for Climate and Sustainable Energy Finance, will give his technical input. This is followed by a question and answer session that I will moderate. So please, if you have any questions, use the Q&A box, which you find below. We will try to include them. And if we have any participants from outside Brazil, please do understand that we will try to focus the discussion on the Brazilian case. So without any further ado, I would like to hand over to Elida from the Ministry of Economy for her opening words.
Bom dia a todos. É um prazer estar nesse webinar com todos vocês. Este webinar é uma contribuição do projeto de Green Finance entre o Brasil e a Alemanha, em que o Ministério da Economia é o parceiro político da Alemanha nesse projeto. Esse projeto de cooperação técnica tem uma duração de 3 anos e meio e tem por objetivo promover as finanças sustentáveis e verdes no país. Do ponto de vista do Ministério da Economia, o aumento de investimentos em setores verdes e sustentáveis é estratégico para alcançar os objetivos de desenvolvimento e crescimento econômico do país. Estruturas regulatórias e políticas adequadas é uma pré-condição importante para a promoção de investimentos verdes e sustentáveis e para o melhor gerenciamento de risco no setor financeiro. Nesse sentido, a Secretaria de Política Econômica tem de forma crescente se dedicado a este tema. Primeiramente, semana passada, disponibilizamos no site do Ministério uma publicação sobre finanças verdes. Nesse contexto, a Secretaria de Política Econômica observa com grande interesse os avanços internacionais do tema. O anúncio recente da Comissão Europeia de pacote legislativo para promover o financiamento sustentável da região é um caso a ser estudado cuidadosamente. O nosso foco é estudar e compreender os avanços da União Europeia na definição de políticas e regulação do setor financeiro para que possamos utilizar essa experiência como input para a construção no país de um arcabouço regulatório capaz de mover a agenda de finanças sustentáveis. Vamos, então, sem mais demora, ouvir a contribuição deste webinar e discutir esta rica contribuição com colaboração do projeto GIZ em conjunto com o LAB. Muito obrigada. Agora eu passo a palavra para o Sebastian, que vai fazer a introdução dos nossos colaboradores. Obrigada.
Muito obrigado, Elida. We appreciate your opening remarks and are looking forward to continuing our joint cooperation to promote green and sustainable finance in Brazil together with the ministry. So we already see the presentation of Frankfurt School on the screen. So you can already see that our technical input provided by Carsten Löffler will follow now. Carsten is not only co-heading the Frankfurt School UNEP Collaborating Center, he's also part of a technical expert group, TEC, preparing the content of some of the new policies on the European level. So step by step, these far-reaching reforms will find their way into policies and regulation for the financial sector, thereby affecting banks, pension funds, insurers, and investors alike. So these actions will help to further mainstream sustainable finance and investment and may become the international benchmark for a sustainable finance policy framework globally. Carsten, thank you very much for your time, and we are looking forward to your input. And for all participants, once again, if you have any questions, please type them in the Q&A box. But for now, over to you, Carsten.
Many thanks, Sebastian and Elida, for your warm words. Most welcome to all participants, wherever you are. It's an honor to be with you. The plan for today is to have a brief outline about what is on the agenda of the European Commission. And then in the second part, we will do a little bit of a deep dive into what is the current status with respect to green taxonomy. And secondly, we will look into disclosure requirements that are now forthcoming. And I will explain a little bit to that more in detail. Let's start. What you see are the official slides from the European Commission that everyone who is involved with this topic is currently using in order to ensure that communication is aligned and that there's kind of no slides flying around that are not centrally set up. So as you can see, we will very briefly look into background on sustainable finance. We will do this very quickly. brief overview on sustainable finance on the EU level, and then it gets into the more technical details, and this is maybe most exciting for everyone to get a glimpse on that, what is actually on the agenda of the technical expert group. To start with, these different sustainability and environmental sustainability definitions out there. Some of these terms you might have come across either in the climate area and with other environmental areas. And this has already a very strong link to the taxonomy, as we will see in a few minutes. Not to forget about that sustainable development is not only about environmental issues, it's about social issues as well and economic issues. The order here is somewhat unusual because usually it's put as economic in the first place and then ESG as an add-on to that. Now the focus of the EU plans is very much on the environmental issues for now, as we will see a little later. What brings the European Commission to taking up this issue of the environment and certainly climate that prominently? First of all, it's because the EU committed to the ambitious climate and energy targets for 2030. And most importantly, the EU has a political target to strive for net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. What is an ambitious target, but that is what science says, what we have to achieve in order to be in line with the Paris Agreement. What it means for the European Union, you see in the, it was these three circles. It's about cutting emissions by 40%, having a share of renewable energy of 32%, what is, of course, maybe slightly different in the Brazilian market already, and have quite some energy savings. And all of these targets are meant for 2030. The analysis the Commission did is leading to the conclusion that there's quite a significant investment gap of what you see the number, roughly a little less than 300 billion euro per year, what certainly cannot be supplied by public money only. Private money has to fill the gap. And in that sense, the private sector will have to play quite a significant role. And now it's about how to incentivize and how to set policy frameworks in a way that this is achieved. This page shows how to set the connection, how to set the overarching framework where sustainable finance actually sits in the EU's sustainability policies. So it's one important pillar next to a few others that deal with climate and energy, environment, and investment and growth. Most interestingly, what the European Union launched is what is commonly subsumed under sustainable finance and the Sustainable Finance Action Plan is actually called the EU Action Plan for Financing Sustainable Growth, meaning it's about finance, of course, but it's meant to be much more holistically than maybe some market participants perceive in the first place. What we have seen so far is that sustainable finance is nothing new. It's not a new kit on the block. There have been, and this is very true for Brazil, of course, for quite a long time, that sustainable finance was pretty much prominent already in some areas. Now, what we have seen in the more recent past is that sustainable finance got slowly, step by little step moved into the more mainstream perception that actually it matters. That is predominantly because it was taken up by regulators, by central banks in particular, with Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, and his landmark report, the Bank of England's landmark report on the British insurance sector in 2015, it was presented, put a framework to the urgency and to the systemic relevance of the financial sector, of climate change in particular on the financial sector. And that, of course, brought the interest and the attention of central banks. And now we have, for instance, the Global Network for Greening the Financial System, where central banks on a global scale convene in order to think, okay, what are the ways regulation has to respond to the challenges around? When we look at the action plan on financing sustainable growth, again, here you can see it. It's, and I start from the bottom, it's about three main goals. It's on the left-hand side, shifting the trillions, actually, and this is what the EU Commission publicly says. It's all about reorienting capital flows towards sustainable investment in order to close the investment gap. Secondly, and this relates to what I just mentioned when it comes to supervision and regulation, it's about understanding risks related to sustainability much, much better and to basically better the understanding in a very broad sense in all kinds of different financial institutions in order to not to be surprised by any developments that are related to sustainability risks, in particular climate that is maybe most prevalent in many, many regions globally. And thirdly, there's quite a systemic gap still, and this is now recognized, that long-term perspectives are insufficiently taken account of in investment and lending decision-making processes. Neglecting by that the longer-term impact any economic activity might have, that is maybe not felt in the short term, but it matters long-term. This area is actually maybe the most challenging to capture, and it hasn't been yet addressed by the EU Commission. And you can see here a variety of 10 different areas that the Commission brought forward. And a subset of this is now dealt with in the technical expert group, i.e. that's number one, the sustainable taxonomy. It's number five, sustainable benchmarks. It's about sustainability in disclosure in particular, number nine. And with respect to an EU green bond standards, it's somewhat sitting there when it comes to setting such a standard, what can maybe also be described as an EU label in the end. And these are exactly the four tasks the EU Commission provided to the technical expert group. The technical expert group started convening last July and formed four subgroups working on each of these four main topics. With the taxonomy, the majority of the tech members works on that area, with experts on the green bond standards. Interestingly, and I won't delve too much into the green bond standard as well as into what is now developed, is now being developed on the low carbon benchmarks. in particular to the second part, low carbon benchmarks, there is now a political agreement that sent the technical expert group back to the drawing board because it differs from what the Commission initially suggested in its regulatory proposals. So now the process to some extent needs to start again. The fourth part is, and we will delve a little deeper on that, it's about disclosure on climate-related information. This is quite an interesting one because it will come into effect pretty soon. And I will talk about that a little later. I already mentioned that's quite a group. We have 35 experts from 17 countries, 15 sectors are represented. There were quite a few submissions to become a member of the technical expert group. And by the way, I don't think I will show that. The technical expert group, in particular for the taxonomy, reached out to further experts, technical experts for different sectors, and all in all, it's the number is around 300 additional experts are being consulted in the process. So it's quite an inclusive process with pretty much different perspectives and ensuring that everyone is heard. Everything, by the way, if you're interested, can be downloaded from the Commission's website. There's quite a bit that can be found there, including the draft regulation. When we look at the taxonomy, now it's getting slightly more interesting when looking into the details. Then, what is the taxonomy about? This is quite an interesting perspective. It's about a list, a taxonomy of environmentally sustainable economic activities. That is very important. That's a starting point, and that is a brief that the EU Commission gave to the technical expert group. There's a few objectives that the technical expert group should take into consideration when coming up with its recommendation, in particular when it comes to what economic activities qualify and will become part of the taxonomy of this list. And first and foremost, it's about the contribution of a defined economic activity, a substantial contribution to the different predefined environmental objectives. And the taxonomy group started with looking at 2 out of 6 environmental objectives. That is climate change, mitigation, and climate adaptation. The 4 others, just to complete this, are sustainable land, sustainable use and protection of water and marine resources. The 4th one is a transition to a circular economy, waste prevention and recycling. The 5th, pollution prevention and control. And last but not least, the 6th, protection of healthy ecosystems. That means the technical expert group just now works on 2 out of 6. And to be frank, the technical expert group won't be possible to cover all economic activities in, with respect to their potential for climate mitigation and climate adaptation. It's just beyond any resources, it's not possible to do that. This is the methodological approach to the qualification of activities for the taxonomy moves on with a testing framework in terms of 2 different criteria, and that's first and foremost, any activity being in the mitigation or adaptation area is supposed not to significantly harm any of the other environmental objectives. Meaning, if there's an activity that maybe contributes to climate mitigation, but actually it would harm climate adaptation, or it would harm any other of the environmental objectives like waste prevention, or actually looking at it holistically, it would actually increase emissions and would not be in line with the 2050 goals, then that activity would not put on the list of environmentally sustainable economic activities. The main bulk of work in the taxonomy group is dealing with finding technical screening criteria to actually determine, okay, is this an activity that would qualify? And to come up with methodologies, metrics, and threshold in order to make market participants, to put market participants in a position to assess what they, to assess economic activities if they would qualify for that list in order to label, to be able to label these activities later. What the taxonomy subgroup needs to do as well is an impact assessment. So this is now currently about to be addressed. But first and foremost, the most important part and the focus for now will be on the first part here. Key features of the taxonomy, and this is quite important to understand what it is, what it's not. It's quite important is that the taxonomy is by definition in the first place static, as it's criteria that are once defined and that will be applicable, say, for the time being. How can this relate to a dynamic environment, to technological improvements? Here, the EU Commission proposes to implement what is called a platform, what is not yet defined, what it actually means and how it will be framed, in order to review frequently on a regular basis the decisions that the technical expert group and then later on the Commission did with respect to the technical screening criteria. So in order to ensure that up-to-date technological developments, maybe a bit of leapfrogging, hopefully, will be reflected within the taxonomy. And it's not an activity, this taxonomy process, that started on scratch. There are already a few taxonomies out there. So the EIB, the European Investment Bank, already worked on a taxonomy. There's a Chinese taxonomy that relates to the Chinese green bonds standard and a few others. So reading that, looking at what is actually available was the starting point. Most important, and maybe that's the area for most confusion, is it's a positive list of activities that contribute to the long-term goal of a net zero carbon economy by 2050. And to avoid on the way to 2050 that activities will qualify under the taxonomy that might lead to lock-in in a way that would not be in line with the long-term goals. The having said that it's a positive list means that there's quite a few activities out there that won't qualify necessarily as green, but they can be just state of the art in an area that is not green and that is not necessarily brown. It's maybe just gray, just neutral. My the examples I tend to use for that is pharmacy, it's pharmaceuticals, for instance, and the telecom sector. Both of them are not necessarily green, but it's very important activities that every economy requires to just be performed. What the taxonomy, in contrast to that, of course, wants to achieve is the facilitation of a transition out of polluting sectors into green sectors, just by flagging what is green, making it easier for market participants to understand what actually qualifies as green from with the perspective of the European Commission. Quite important as well is for the taxonomy to be technology neutral. That is in particular very important for the energy sector. It is competing ways of using energy, producing power, for instance. So the decision that was made is that there's a uniform threshold in the end that will apply to every sector, for instance, that is power generating. How it can then look in applying the taxonomy, so this is trying to explain it on the slide. It's quite an interesting perspective. It's maybe the easiest way to understand this slide is to start in the second line where it's stated companies on the left-hand side. You see company A and company B. Company A carries out, as it's stated here, 60% of taxonomy compliant activities, for instance, by revenues. Whereas company B does 20%. So here was the example of passenger rail transport. Now they may issue shares, they may issue bonds. In this case, a green bond is issued that will finance the green area of company B. Then what would it mean for financial sector participants, for investment, for investment funds, for insurance companies, how they would qualify and how would they come to an overall to portfolio wide number, in terms of the share of taxonomy compliant activities within the portfolio. And as you can see, it's in a simplified model on the left-hand side. Example one, it's an equity fund with a green label, actually, that buys shares from different companies. And you see the upper right is company A and the center company is company B with respective green shares that are compliant with the taxonomy. Meaning, actually, one can compute an average percentage of the fund in line with the taxonomy. And this is a figure that then can be publicized and can be used in showcasing, to what extent, at least for this for the status quo, the fund is in line with maybe green targets. One has to take into consideration here, of course, that taxonomy is only dealing with two pillars of its in total six pillars, as mentioned before, and that even in the two pillars, not all economic activities will be covered. See, it's a work in progress. Here, the aim is just to show, how it might work. Another very important element of this is to what extent financial institutions actually know what is happening on the level of company A and company B. For that, company A and company B would have to publicize or maybe to put forward to Bloomberg or Reuters or what there will be other data provider, the share of taxonomy compliant activities. So in order to have an easy way for asset managers and the like to get access to these numbers. Eventually, it means that the data, unless there's a close proximity, for instance, with green bonds to the actual asset and the actual activity, the emphasis will be, and the prerequisite will be, that the investee companies will provide respective data. This is a brief illustration of the economic activities that were covered in the first round that took place in the second half year, in the starting 6 months of the taxonomy working group. Basically, it's about the more easy, the easier areas. Whereas second round mitigation activities got a little more tricky, and in that respect, there's quite a bit of discussions ongoing. That's what I can say. The taxonomy group will publish its report mid June, and everything will be put up for public consultation that is open to everyone over the summer for roughly 8 weeks or 2 months. Here it's shown what the main sectors covered are about. Basically, it's about north of 80% of EU emissions that should be covered by the taxonomy group in the first place. This is very wordy. It's just one example, and it's a little outdated, I have to admit, because it's from last December, but this is what is available publicly right now for one of the energy sectors here, geothermal. And you see on the left-hand side, the principal metric is threshold, what was published for consultation then. And you see these five do no significant harm assessment areas: adaptation, water, circular economy, pollution, and ecosystems. There's no expectation for you to read it now, that can be done later. But you get a flavor of what this is about. And I can share this is just the tip of the iceberg. This I just mentioned, so we are just in the process of preparing the report that will be published. There was a little bit of feedback to the first round. I will skip this because of time and would like to go to disclosures. What was the objective with respect to disclosures? Let me frame it that way. There's non-financial reporting guidelines or a directive, actually. It's mandatory law for certain companies above 500 employees that are listed. I have to provide information on their impact on the environment, for instance. And this non-financial reporting directive, in short NFRD, is accompanied by so-called non-binding guidelines. These non-binding guidelines explain what is expected, or what the commissions expects companies to provide in terms of information. And these non-binding guidelines get updated from time to time, and that is actually what is happening right now. So these guidelines will soon be updated based on the recommendations by the technical expert group. The technical expert group published a recommendation earlier this year in January. This was taken up by and large by the Commission, and the Commission did a public consultation over spring. And I would expect now these non-binding guidelines to be updated pretty soon, meaning that this will have an effect on market participants in terms of what is in the non-binding guidelines is the first starting point. And if there's deviation from these guidelines, that has to be explained. What is different and what will be different compared to the previous non-binding guidance is actually that the recommendations by the Financial Stability Board's Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, and I would expect that most of you will be very familiar with the recommendation, will be very broadly integrated into the newly written non-binding guidelines. Meaning there's quite some change when it comes to climate-related metrics. And this may have quite some effect and will and basically takes up legislation that we already see in some other countries, in particular France, that introduced into law already 2015, something pretty similar. So this is basically what I just explained. So we will have the non-binding guidelines based on the NFRD directive, based on the TCFD recommendations. So pretty wordy, but you can read it later. Just briefly, and these are now 5 points I would like to briefly draw your attention on before I close. First, it's all about reporting and transparency and disclosure. So what this is about is to provide the market, investors in particular, and of course other stakeholders with high quality information. And this now includes climate-related disclosure that complies with the NFRD and with TCFD recommendations. So this is kind of the broad framework. And what it in particular does is addressing gaps in the current reporting practice. And because it's now going to be a European standard, it will enable comparability across different European jurisdictions. And as earlier mentioned, of course, the main goal again and again and again of all these measures is to support the EU's decarbonization efforts. So what is now falling under the disclosures? What is the structure of it? So the proposed guidelines that the technical expert group came up with, and now likely the European Commission will enact. It's quite more detailed, but still quite flexible. And one of the most important perspectives is that the inside-out perspective is now accompanied by the outside-in. So what actually does it mean? That the environment might change, that climate change will kick in, what that means in terms of risk and opportunities, and how to measure this. And one of the most important pieces that will contribute to that is that there's motivation to conduct scenario analysis based on pathways that, of course, might put the users of that guideline a little bit into a challenging position, because it's based on different pathways. That means there needs to be ideally some understanding about, okay, what is available in terms of pathways, because 2050 goals can be achieved with different pathways. We can go on like that as business as usual, only with the effect that we will have to decarbonize much more strictly a little later, or we can just start now and it's getting a little more smoothly. to that goal. So that's just to map out what is meant with pathways in this respect. And of course, there's a linkage made to the taxonomy, though one has to admit that the taxonomy is not still there. It has not landed. So we will have to see what that actually then will mean. Third point is that it's important that the alignment of the NFRD and TCFD is now basically broadly ensured. So that it's, say, if one company wants to report or needs to report on the NFRD and wants to do it under the TCFD, then there's no two reportings required, but it's just one. So there's different levels of disclosure. There's should disclose in terms of various high level areas like the business model, like policies and due diligence, like outcomes, like main risks and their management, and about key performance indicators. Some of you might recognize that it's 5 compared to 4 under the TCFD. This, from my perspective, does not make any material difference. It's just structured slightly differently. Then, and on the right-hand side, there's a little bit of a materiality that shows here. So the issues with the biggest materiality with the biggest impact, what is called here high expectation. So what every company should disclose, that is, of course, foreseen. And then what is expected of companies in addition is that significant, where significant exposure, and that is what I meant with materiality, needs to be disclosed as well, so as a supplementary disclosure. Whereas maybe less material parts can, of course, be disclosed. So it's a three-pronged approach in that respect. In that sense, bottom line for the disclosures, it's that there's minimum disclosures that are expected from everyone. And that is relating to governance processes and strategy and risk management processes. And last but not least, scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. That is quite interesting because there's quite some debate about how to measure. In particular, sometimes, so for financial institutions, it's easy. But scope 1 and scope 2 is a nice to have. What's here is not included is scope 3, what then is leading to the perspective of the life cycle emissions that will be pretty important when it comes to addressing risk matters, because life cycle emissions, imagine the car automotive sector, account for the bulk of the emissions and are prone for regulation. And as such, if there's pressure on scope 3 emissions, that might have an immediate importance for any company that is exposed to such risks. So basically, as I said before, the new approach under the NFRD is about how climate change might affect the business model and vice versa, how activities might affect climate change. And this is not only for the short term, but explicitly for the medium and long term. There's a little bit of an addition with respect to sector-specific guidance. because as you know, the financial sector performs quite a variety of business models. And so there's a little bit of an alignment with the requirements in that respect. But there's, of course, common pieces, and that you can find here on the right-hand side. And it's about how the business model is positioned, how the policies are embedded in this positioning, and how the impact of climate change is managed. And it's carved out of the in this disclosure framework because the financial sector has quite a key role to play, and it's kind of at the end of an investment chain, basically, as financiers of the economy. So they're all risks can be found in a portfolio context, and as such, the perspective on it, on these risks from a holistic perspective, needs to be ensured. Yeah, that's where we are now. That's what I mentioned earlier. We will have the publication of the updated non-binding guidelines. I would expect this to happen pretty soon. That's at least what I tend to hear in the corridors. Watch out for that. There's a few outreach activities. I don't think that is that important. I already mentioned with respect to the taxonomy, what is here is the past and the future I mapped out. Yeah, and I think that's where it landed. And I think we should use the remaining time for Q&A.
Thank you very much, Carsten, for this very interesting input. And before I open the floor to the other participants, and I have already collected two or three questions from the floor, and I would like to encourage you to send in more questions if you have any. I would like to start with one or two questions from my side. The first one being, I take two particularly interesting issues from this example of a policy framework. The first one is on the process. So you already mentioned this quite extensive dialogue between public and private side. So on the public side, you have the European Commission and the Parliament. On the private side, you have the HLEC, the High Level Expert Group that you didn't mention here so much, and the Technical Expert Group, the TEC, as well as the public consultation. So I think that's very interesting how this whole process and how the content of the policies actually develop. And on the other hand, what I find interesting is this very comprehensive approach. So if you look back on the slide that you presented with the 10 different actions, they really materialize in various parts of the financing chain and various actors and various aspects of financing. And we have named this or titled this webinar and asked the question whether this will be something like an international benchmark to others. So that would actually be my question. How are others learning from that already? Do we see different debates in other jurisdictions? How do they tackle this problem? Is there also maybe a challenge when it comes to fragmentation also of these different policies in an environment that is very global, in particular when it comes to investments?
Yeah, that is a very relevant point. Thank you for asking, Sebastian. See, first of all, it's of course meant for the European Union and for use within the European Union. But for sure, everyone who wants to do business in the European Union would have to follow these regulations that are very likely to come into place and to some extent are already there. The ambition is to establish a global framework. And that can be seen that there's intense talks, for instance, with the Chinese to land in the same place, in order to avoid what you just mentioned, i.e. fragmentation. And there's quite some outreach activities by the EU Commission, to my knowledge at least, and to some other countries, to show what is happening and to motivate. Okay, maybe it's not a bad idea to follow that very path. One has to say, and then you see this here as well. It's a step-by-step approach. Not everything can be done at the same time. We will have European elections actually in 1.5 weeks. So we will have a new European Parliament pretty soon. And the European Commission will change as well sometime in fall, so likely sometime around November. And it will be quite important to see what the political priorities will be with respect to sustainable finance. What I've seen so far is that it's pretty unlikely that they will change much in that respect. So we will see further activities coming from the European level for the whole of Europe, that the agenda will be pushed forward for the next years. For the taxonomy, for instance, the European Commission mapped out a plan to land somewhere with a more complete taxonomy by 2022. And by that, you can already see that it's quite an effort. What it means for other countries, like Brazil as well, but many others as well, is I think to follow it very closely, to see what is there, what to learn from, and maybe to learn even from mistakes, because it won't be perfect. I don't think so. It's a little bit of though many market practitioners have been involved, the technical expert group, for instance, is all market practitioners, like the previous high-level expert group who actually came up with the bulk of the plans that the EU Commission took up and promoted it now with as part of its action plan on financing sustainable growth. So what we see here is coming from the very market. It's nothing that the EU Commission just imagined and just dreamed up. It's areas where market practitioners say, okay, we have to address this. Markets might not be the might not solve everything, so we will have to think about regulation here and there, because there's just some issues like with short-termism versus long-term perspectives that are required more and more. These are very, very tricky to be taken into consideration by the market, just just very basically. Okay. So in that respect, bottom line, I think it's meant to be a global perspective by the EU Commission that I can positively say.
And maybe just for information purposes, to you and maybe also to the other listeners, we are in close coordination and contact with the European Commission and their outreach instruments, which are just forming, so to say, and are in a dialogue in how far, maybe via the project, we can also support this process and engage into a dialogue with Brazil on this topic on a more formal level. We have received one question that maybe can relate also to what you have just mentioned, because the question was, in how far would this EU, if you don't take it on a global level, but already what's happening on the EU level, in how far will this have an effect on investments to Brazil, to Brazil from Europe? So in how far does it affect the Brazilian market already now, when the jurisdiction that it actually is regulating is in Europe? Can you foresee something?
Yeah, that's a perfect question, because the investors located in the European Union will have to report that's what I would expect over time. So it's non-binding guidelines. So there's a little bit of voluntary elements here and there still. But basically, what this what it entails is clearly, if someone decides to report accordingly, that would be for the entire portfolio, and that includes investments irrespective of them being in the European Union or elsewhere.
Easy
response is yes, it's included basically.
Okay, so it's included as of now, in particular, let's say at the end of the financing chain, so at the project level, if there are companies here, bonds here placed at the local market representing local projects, that obviously the investors from Europe have to become or will become, let's say, more picky what they invest in, yeah, also on an international level. Because they would have to report on it.
Yes, yeah. So that depends very much on the investors in the first place. No? So I wouldn't expect the impact to be too large in the first place, at least broadly speaking, because it's still it will be a process of familiarization with, in particular, the taxonomy. And it's still, there's no requirement to invest only in taxonomy compliant bonds or green bonds, if you want. So any investor is of course free to do whatever he or she wants to do. What it adds is a requirement to be transparent on what investments will qualify, to what extent, like in this small graph, with respect to the taxonomy. And then the numbers may be sometimes a little larger if it's in compliance, and it would be smaller if it's not in compliance. It's not necessarily saying, okay, it's bad, not at all, when it's not falling under the taxonomy. It can have a reason, for instance, that it's just a sector or an activity that has not yet been covered. Very simple. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, one has to see this in context.
Mm-hmm. Maybe looking forward a little bit, yeah. I mean, we have already said that from the topics that it's covering, it's a very comprehensive reform approach. But you have also, for example, mentioned in the taxonomy discussion that we have a positive list. So we are focusing on the issues that are brown, and we don't have like on the green, we don't have like a brown penalizing, a brown exclusion here in the taxonomy. And I guess that you can translate this also to other parts of the regulation. So where is it maybe not ambitious enough? Where do you think is room for the future? And maybe also what is the dialogue here, and how far does the political level still obviously have an effect on what the experts are drafting? I don't think they can do it in free space. Yeah, they have certain borders, I guess, along which they can discuss, right?
Yeah, so the technical expert group is absolutely free in whatever it wants to recommend. So there's if the taxonomy working group wants to issue a report on this or that, what's in, what's not in, so there's complete freedom to do so. In the end, the commission is a body. If the regulation will come into effect like it's proposed, to set the final qualifications. So it's just a recommendation. One has to say that, in particular with the taxonomy, so of course the commission came up with its own proposal last May. The European Parliament settled with their negotiating position end of March this year. In the European setting, there's then a third body, that is the Council, that is where the member states, the 28 member states, meet. The Council hasn't formed its own position yet. that's just starting. It's a little bit up in the air where it will land and when it will land. I hear some rumors okay. It will maybe land there's earlier than later, but there's some uncertainty. So the political process is right now in full swing, and this what is called a trilogue, what is actually these three bodies negotiating a political deal in the end, has not yet started, and there it will become very interesting. Where it will land, I think it's most likely that the Commission's regulatory proposal will change to some extent. There's a few points that member states have some issues with, and we'll see where the compromise then can be gained.
So it's still a political process, yeah.
It's a political
process.
Various
member states, obviously. So I guess they are also different. What's green in France may not be green in Germany, may not be green in other states. Yeah, I think that's also an interesting debate. But Carsten, you have recently been to Brazil. We have jointly looked at what are the frameworks here. What is the supportive environment for green and sustainable finance? Taking the discussion a little bit to the Brazilian case. Without now wanting from you to say we have to change exactly this law by this and that, but where should Brazil take the next steps? Yeah, if you look at some of the publications 5 years ago, Brazil was at the forefront. Yeah, it was always an exemplary case. The central bank regulation, for example, was always very prominently stated. Now it was getting a little bit quiet. What are the next steps that Brazil can take in order to support green and sustainable finance from a policy or regulatory perspective?
Let me start with one point that I find is very important, and that is true for everywhere. Doing sustainable finance will be good business. It's kind of future-proofing the financial system, basically. It's just very obvious. We have to take into account longer-term risks in order to ensure that an economy will flourish not only next year and the year after, but in a decade, two decades, 3 decades, 5 decades.
It's a stability question.
It's a stability question long term. Now, of course, we can say in 50 years, maybe most of us will be in pension age or maybe dead. But what do we want? No? And taking into account these long term perspectives is, I think, it's really a big issue that everyone will be well advised to do this now. I understand completely, and this is. That is true for everywhere as well, that in a policy process that is naturally geared more towards the short term and the short term effects on an economy, this does not come without challenges. So what the financial sector cannot do is to fix issues that basically sit in the real economy. So I would say the companies that really do kind of producing goods, for instance, or extracting resources, whatever. Not to forget about this, but the financial sector certainly has to play a decisive role in order to understand in its own investment and lending decisions what it actually means in the long term, what effect it has, and what to do and maybe what not to do, and maybe even to reflect these longer term risks even in its pricing structures. So having said that, and it's not a direct response to your question, I would tend to look in the first place, for sure, and that is what everyone does, to more transparency, and actually, and this is the biggest issue to get one's head around, and it's everywhere the same, to understand risks that kind of hidden right now within lending and investment portfolios much, much better. I.e. trying to get a grip on it with starting with a simple scenario analysis So in order to understand, okay, what are the sensitivities? So only what you know, you can manage. That would be my conclusion. There's a specific difficulty with the Brazilian market, I think, when it comes to how to invest in a sustainable way. I think there's plenty of investment opportunities around, but there's quite some big companies that may sometimes be challenged, and in particular when it comes to fossil fuel-based business models that, at least according to science, need to be phased out over the coming decades. So there's not too much opportunity to avoid these larger companies in an investment approach that is linked to a domestic benchmark, for instance, with quite some prominent companies with quite some significant shares in these benchmarks. So one can maybe approach this with an underweight on these companies, but of course it means, and this is always a challenge for every portfolio manager, it comes with a risk when these sectors outperform the market. So that means automatic underperformance. So that the flip side of that is, okay, what is the right measure in terms of performance? And so one measures short-term performance. That's nice, but actually, what do we want to achieve? We want to achieve long-term performance. And here we again see some systemic challenges in the sector.
And probably this issue of transparency and disclosure is an easy start. Yeah, it doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt so much. Not like other interventions on a policy level. And you basically, as a regulator, you pass it on to somebody else. Yeah? It's not necessarily your own work in the first place.
Yeah, but it does not come without efforts, and even a regulator is quite well advised to think diligently, okay, how to frame it and what to expect then from reportees. So the French example I find is quite interesting because they approach it in a very open way. So you just say, okay, please do, and then let's see what comes.
But we are also in a very early stage, the instruments are not there yet, so I think it might be a good starting point to approach it like this and say comply or explain, and you tell us what you think is most relevant and how to do it, and then we as a regulator can also see what is being put forward, because there is no standard yet with respect to that reporting, right?
Yeah, and interestingly, so the French government runs a competition with market participants on who's actually doing the best reporting. So
yeah, that's actually a very might be a nice proposal for some regulatory action. Yeah, to have this kind of competition towards the top. Yeah.
So this can be one approach. So what one sees in other markets, and it's very kind of it's very localized because markets tick pretty differently. So in some markets, self-regulation actually works pretty well. So kind of a hint to maybe an industry association. Okay, please say we want to see this or that. Do you want us to regulate, or do you want to regulate yourself? But please, seriously, so in a serious way. So in some markets, that worked pretty nicely. One has to see. And I'm not in a position to say for the Brazilian market what is the best solution. So what I want to say is there's different avenues one can pursue, and one has to see what works in a market context.
One additional question, and I would like to I would like you to answer not from a member of a tech, but taking that experience that you have gained in the process, also on the issue of taxonomy, but from, let's say, a private sector expert. Is a public actor the best stakeholder to define a taxonomy for the market? I mean, you have explained how difficult it is, how dynamic this process must be, what kind of expertise you need in various parts of this taxonomy, from mitigation, various technologies, to adaptation, where maybe there are no really standardized methods out there. And then also taking into consideration this issue of fragmentation. So who should do it? How do we get to a global a taxonomy that's the same for everybody? And who should be the one that writes it further as we are developing? Because what's green today may not be green tomorrow.
Yeah, no, it has to be a living instrument. That's without saying. So with respect to the question, okay, public sector or someone else, if there's a taxonomy that needs to be applied broadly for a market, I don't think there's any other institution that can do that. With the limitations that taxonomy has, of course, because that is what comes up very frequently. It's all about, okay, can we mirror a complex reality and a taxonomy. And I would say this is a big challenge because reality is most often much more complex than anything than a taxonomy can actually provide. So it's, I think, an important step at least to start with and to see how this is going to work. In particular, when it comes to economic activities that have impacts on kind of on the value chain, on other products that are based on an input product, see, then it gets sometimes a little tricky in order to map kind of a handprint. No? So you kind of there's an activity that emits a little bit of CO2 and maybe even quite a bit. And then this is a critical input for an activity that can't be done without, that actually saves so much more CO2 further down the value chain. To capture all this is tricky.
I mean, you said something that's, I think, very valuable for this discussion. You said, who else could set a taxonomy if it's not a public sector institution? But maybe there is a link to the content. I mean, what would you think of a taxonomy where maybe the public sector sets like the very wide guidelines, something that you have outlined in one of your slides where you said these are the different areas from mitigation to adaptation to circular economy, waste prevention and so on, and says, okay, it must contribute, something green must contribute positively to at least one of these areas, cannot be negatively to any of the others to a considerable degree. But when it comes to the details, we as the regulator refer to, for example, what's happening on the ISO standards, because they are working on a taxonomy as well. I would believe it's a little bit, maybe a little bit less politically exposed than if you would relate it, for example, to a Chinese taxonomy. You would expect that this is written forward in the future. Is that something that could find that where you could find this balance, setting some baseline, some guidelines, but then referring to a taxonomy that's already out there also to prevent this kind of fragmentation?
I don't think there's a good response to that. I would be interested to listen to maybe people smarter than I am. Basically, it's about, say, choosing a principled approach or a more prescriptive approach. In the regulatory proposal, and that is what the tech is then hard to follow, it's a more prescriptive approach. So there's no alternative for the tech to follow any other approach because it's outside.
Okay, of that's given for you. Yeah,
that's a given. So I can only look at it from the outside. Now, so as a non-tech member or kind of doing it in an abstract way. A principled approach has quite some benefits, but it comes not without consequences, and that in particular is relevant with respect to when it's up for interpretation what qualifies as green and sustainable. Mm-hmm. Then it's quite open doors for quite some flexible treatment, so that mm-hmm. maybe more than what can seriously be qualified under such a taxonomy would then be qualified, and who's then going to police that? Mm-hmm. So that is a little bit of a tricky issue with respect, and I don't have any conclusions to that.
Would you say that it's a better starting point, the principle-based approach, in particular for more emerging sectors that are in a learning process?
Actually, I think to some extent it's unavoidable to go in that way, as you say, just for these areas. For instance, when we look at adaptation, so what qualifies as adaptation? It can be everything and nothing. Depending on context, it's very context related, making maybe activities more resilient, and there's some obvious investments, of course, no? So building a wall or a dike or so, that's maybe qualifies instantly as adapting to a changing environment. There's many other issues that might not be that obvious. So a somewhat principled approach needs to be taken, I think, and it will be taken.
Okay.
With mitigation, it's a little easier, because mitigation means, okay, there's something that can be
sure, you can measure, yeah. Yeah, totally.
And then there's just to conclude with that, there's one aspect when one looks at 2050, ideally we will have then a net zero carbon economy, but how to get there, and then whether will still be emitting sectors to some extent, so there will be have to be carbon sinks to some extent. And say, will the taxonomy or does the taxonomy allocate certain shares of emissions to certain sectors? No, it does not. So, so this kind of systemic perspective cannot be addressed by, to my opinion,
only by the taxonomy.
No, it kind of cannot be solved, no? Because when it's about activities or even a principled approach, say having a global perspective, so it's not allocating emissions to this or that activity. It cannot be done. So that's kind of a godly plan.
Yeah. At the same time, if you look at the actions of the EU action plan, they are also to a certain degree promoting or steering in the future their own investments towards more sustainability. Yeah? So they are also tackling it a little bit from this investment side as well. One last question from my side. That is an observation, and it was also part of your presentation, that there is a strong focus on the E part of the ESG. Yeah, it's a very climate-driven approach. At the same time, you can see that the instruments that would also relate, for example, to wider SDG. G financing or sustainable financing in a wider approach would be similar. So, I mean, obviously, we know where this interest is coming from. It's a very politically driven interest. It's fulfilling certain international and national goals also. And obviously, it's a very pressing issue, the issue of climate change. Why do we not integrating it more into a more joint sustainable finance approach? Is it too complex then? Do we have to start somewhere? Does it not really go together? What's your perspective?
I think you relate to maybe mapping investment portfolios to the SDGs. This is increasingly done. It's not an easy task to do. And it's more for illustrative purposes in the end. It's in order to show, okay, what the impact might be with respect to one of the 17 SDGs.
But also the taxonomy, for example, the social link and the governance link in that is weak, I would say. There was some disappointment also from some people on the regulation saying we have a taxonomy now that looks at climate friendliness of an investment. It doesn't look whether it fulfills a social approach, so to say, besides like some minimum criteria.
So we have the minimum social safeguards criteria, what is basically international labor law,
ILO laws.
For instance, that's true. It's so it's a focus on the E of ESG, clearly so. It's a debate, and the Commission, to my understanding, is faced with this debate again and again. It's not an easy thing to do, no, for sure not. My expectation will be that this will be addressed at some point, necessarily so, because if one wants to go along with the SDGs, it's not about the E just as a standalone. It needs to be integrated. But this is very much my own perspective. For now, because not everything can be done at the same time, the focus is on parts of the E.
Okay. Carsten, thank you very much. Would you like to close here from a technical perspective? Is there anything that you would like to, a main message that you would like to give to the, maybe on the Brazilian case?
I think with respect to the Brazilian case, and I think everyone will benefit from following what actually will happen and what the learnings will be. I think there will be, in the end, a global understanding about sustainable finance. It will be more aligned, in particular because the large markets like the European Union and to quite some extent the Chinese policymakers already now work together on achieving that and then achieving a mutual understanding. What might lead at a later point in time to a more global standard. And of course, one will have to see what will happen politically in the US. But already now on the ground, one can see that there's quite some interest in decarbonization and getting portfolios aligned with large pension funds. So actually it's happening already from the ground up. In that respect, sustainable finance, from my perspective, is just something that will stay, that we will have to deal with. We'll have to find good ways to establish that more mainstream. And what we see now in the European market is, and more globally actually, is with this network of
cleaning the financial system.
Of central banks. It's high on the agenda of regulators, and this will have for sure quite an impact on the financial sector. So watch out, more to come.
Thank you very much, Carsten. And I think this focus also on international collaboration is something that I couldn't have said better, because it's in the heart of our project. It's in the heart of the partnership also between Germany and Brazil in this project, and the lab on a broader scale, bringing together various institutions from the financial sector to discuss on this topic. So we will surely make our part, do our homework to support this agenda, and I'm looking forward to this. I would like to thank you very much, Carsten, for this insights from what's happening on the European level, and I'm looking forward to take this discussion further with the ministry, with the central bank, with other institutions to see what we can learn from that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thanks so much to everyone. Greetings to Brazil, wherever you are, Sao Paulo, Rio, Brasilia. So it was a pleasure traveling and talking maybe even to some of you earlier this year. Thanks from my side as well. And yeah, I think it's Bom Dia still. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. You can steal that. It's now after lunchtime, I think, or approaching lunchtime. So I think it's also about time to stop the webinar and let you enjoy your well-deserved evening. Yeah, in Germany. Yeah. So thank you very much once again, and also okay. To everyone else listening. Have a nice afternoon.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you, bye-bye. Everyone. Bye bye.